Well, this is Pete Fornital on the Sunday Show. Paul Simon has been, is, and will continue to be one of the most influential musicians of his generation. And we spent some time together last Friday afternoon talking about his new album, The Rhythm of the Saints, and a variety of other subjects. And we'll begin presenting that conversation for you this morning at about 9 o'clock. That's 35 minutes from right now. And until then, we'll have some selections from Paul's solo career. And coming up next, some interesting Paul Simon covers after these messages. This is Pete Fornital back with you on the Sunday Show with my special guest this morning, Paul Simon. Paul, it has been 4 years now since Graceland. When we spoke at that time, the album had just been released and the jury was still out on how it would be received. We all know what happened. Triumph in every respect. Was it successful beyond your wildest expectations?
Yes, it was successful beyond my expectations, but I, people often ask me this, you know, was I surprised that the Graceland was such a success? And I really can't say that I was surprised, because I really liked South African music. I mean, I liked it a lot. So the fact that millions of people felt the same way, it really wasn't surprising to me. I mean, I wouldn't have been surprised if the album had not been successful.
What were some of the most personally memorable moments for you attached to the entire Graceland project?
Well, there was the initial recording with, you know, with the different players. There was my meeting with Ray Peary and my first meeting with Joseph Shabalala. Then there was the concert in Zimbabwe with Hugh Masekela and Miriam Makeba. I guess the Grammy, winning the Grammy, was memorable. And different concerts, you know, stick out. There was a concert at Madison Square Garden that was a particularly good concert, where the band was really together. It was towards the end of the tour. I think the video with Chevy is something that I, you know, that I'll always remember. It was like we were laughing so much with it, and we did it in about three takes.
It seems to me that the Graceland experience must have been reaffirming to you as an artist coming off of the Hearts and Bones experience. Did you measure it that way? I mean, there are some practical record business attachments to these experiences. Hearts and Bones, which I think is one of your great albums, was not received the way I would have liked it to have been, and I think the way you would have liked it to have been. So, did Graceland erase some of those feelings?
Yes. Yeah. There was still the unusual aspect of having a big hit album without it getting radio play, a lot of radio play. And that, I think, was partly the result of Hearts and Bones, and partly the result of the format style of radio programming. So, in effect, Graceland was really a hit album from word of mouth.
Hmm.
Really.
Hearts and Bones, I just want to talk about for another second. What could have been different about that album so that it would be more widely known than it perhaps is?
Well, it could have been a better record, in my opinion.
Ah, okay.
I think there were two or three songs on there that I like. But I didn't make really good records of them. With the exception of Hearts and Bones, the title track, I think that was a nice record. But, you know, again, in a certain style that would not have fit into format. I mean, those songs were no more hit singles than The Boy in the Bubble was, or Graceland. I mean, the song Graceland, which won a Grammy as Record of the Year, Single of the Year, was on the charts for 3 weeks. Never got higher than 81, and then people stopped playing it. And in fact, Graceland, the song, is the continuation of the story that starts in Hearts and Bones. They go together.
One and one half wandering Jews.
Pete Fornatale back with you on the Sunday show with my guest this morning, Paul Simon. Paul, a big success always puts a little extra pressure on the follow-up project. Did you feel that in connection with the new one?
No, I didn't really feel it. Once I had my concept down. Then it was really about pursuing it and realizing it in the fullest musical sense. And that was what I was thinking about. And I really don't begin to think about what will people think, and will this be a hit, and will they be disappointed, and after Graceland. I really didn't start to think about that until the record was finished and the marketplace started to loom before me, and I had to do, interviews and press, and then almost everybody asked me this question, you know. But and then I started to think about it. Well, I wonder if they will like this as much, or, you know, will people be disappointed? Will this be, too far out there? I really didn't know, but whatever doubts that I may have had or questions that came up, they came up after the record and was finished, and so they had no impact whatsoever on the decisions that I was making during the course of the recording of The Rhythm of the Saints.
It's truly a privileged and fortunate position to be in, not to have to concern yourself with the conventions of what radio is doing at a given moment. Many artists are slavish to that and have to be, and you don't, and it's a wonderful, I would think it's a wonderful position to be able to operate from.
Well, it is at this moment in time, because Graceland was a big hit and it wasn't in the format of radio, and so I really wasn't penalized. But essentially, there's not much, again, you know, thinking about what radio is going to play is really not going to do me much good anyway, because I'm not going to be able to make those records anyway. No. So I have to be prepared, and I am prepared to have resistance on a radio level, particularly Top 40 radio, which is very different sounding from what I do, and I accept that. You know, it may be that Top 40 will become more eclectic, and their programming thing will get looser. That would be great, I think, because I mean, when I grew up, radio was very eclectic, and you could hear all kinds of different music on it, from Frankie Lyman to Ray Charles to Jerry Lee Lewis and Johnny Cash, and doo-wop to rhythm and blues to Sun Records, and they were very kind of, you know, Louisiana music. Very different kinds of music, which was all just called rock and roll, which I just thought of all as rock and roll. But today, I mean, that would be divided into, Top 40, or, urban, whatever names they put on things, country, and then it wasn't. And it made for a magical world that, as a child, listening to it,
As you were speaking, I was envisioning the Steve Martin routine where he says, maybe this will be the album that opens up radio formats and makes them see the possibility of the integration of cultures. Yes, maybe this will be the one that will bring things to... Nah.
Yeah.
You're up against a big wall on that front.
Well, I think one of the consequences of this kind of thinking is the polarization that you feel in society today.
And in the city today.
And definitely you feel it in the city, but all throughout society. You don't get a chance to hear what the best of another group is coming up with.
Well, I may be stretching this, and you'll be the one to tell me, but I hear on this record the heirs to the sounds that excited you in that era. The heirs, by that I mean, obviously developed to
another. Yes, I know what you mean.
To another step on this record, is that
I
so?
I agree with you, yeah.
Great.
Yeah. I'm always searching for those sounds that I remember when I was 12 years old, 13 years old. And, of course, they may not be recognizable to anyone else as that sound, but I hear it. And I think one of the reasons that people sometimes think that these last few records are so exotic is because those sounds sounded exotic to me then. I mean, growing up in Queens and hearing music that came from Memphis or New Orleans or even a street corner in Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty exotic.
First thing I remember, I was lying in my bed. Couldn't have been no more than one or two.
When did this project really begin to percolate? Take on a focus, a shape, a form? When did it become manageable, moldable, and handleable for you?
When Milton Nascimento asked me to do a duet with him on one of his albums in 1987. It was after that recording, which was took place in Los Angeles in the summer of 87, that Milton said, come down to Brazil. And I went down in March of 88. That's when I began.
So when you went back, what awaited you there? What did you discover?
Well, I went, I think people sometimes think that I'm off on a vacation as opposed to like that I'm going to a recording studio, going from a hotel room to a recording studio. But I cut two or three tracks in Rio, just drums. I was interested in only recording drums. I didn't want any other instruments. Just drums that came from the West African tradition. So not a trap set, but congas, bongos, bata, bass drums, all kinds of percussion added, cowbells, triangles, gourds, all kinds of the Brazilian sounds. So I cut two or three tracks in the studio in Rio, and then we went up to Salvador Bahia in the north of Brazil, and I saw this group, amazing group called Olo Doom. And they were playing in the square at night in the old part of the city of Salvador, with cobblestones and old churches, pink and gray churches. And in fact, the video of Obvious Child shows where I recorded it, because I went back to do the video there. So this group, Olo Doom, was 14 drums, 10 bass drums, and 4 snare drums. Enormous sound, enormous power. I wanted to record with them. There was no recording studio in Salvador, so we brought an 8-track machine up from Rio, and we recorded in the street, in the square, at night. It was like about 100 people hanging around, and there were television cameras. It was a big event in Salvador, Bahia. Hung the microphones up on, telephone lines and stuck them wherever we could to, set it up, and did it just about like a field recording. So those are the first tracks I did. That was in March of 88. The next time I came, I recorded with a group called Wakti. And that's the second track, Can't Run But. they invent their instruments. They play these kind of marimba instruments, but the leader of the group invented them. And the bass sound on the record is this long industrial tubing cut to a certain length to produce a tone, and then they would hit it with a foam rubber pad at the top, and it would go boom, 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 you know. Boom, 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 boom. It's not a bass. Those are long tubes. Hi, this is Paul Simon, and you're listening to Pete Fornatel on New York's Classic Rock and Roll Radio, 92.3 K-Rock. Through friends of Hugh Masekela, I met Vincent Ngini, a guitarist who comes from Cameroon, lives in D.C. And we began to work together with these tracks and to make up like the forms of a song. So we'd sit in the studio back here in New York and play the tracks over and over again and put in a guitar part in a West African style. And once the form was established, I would begin to improvise melodies, and after a while, maybe a couple of months, the melodies would turn into sounds, and the sounds would turn into words, and the words might, you know, some sentence or line would be interesting, and I think, yeah, that's good, let me stay with that, and maybe that's what the song's about, or I don't know what that is, so maybe I won't use it. And then later on I'd think, oh, now I know what that line means, and I'd stick it in, you know, like, the cross is in the ballpark, and or why deny the obvious, child? I mean, I didn't really know why I was writing that when I first wrote it.
Let's stick with the lyric writing for just a moment. When it comes to that point of the process, do you do it on some preordained schedule, or is it more random?
No, I stay to a schedule.
It's a morning schedule.
I write out in Montauk. It's quiet. There's nobody around. And I get up pretty early. I mean, pretty early for a musician, you know. But it's, you know, I'm at work. I'm working by 9 o'clock. And I work for 3 or 4 hours, maybe more if I'm going good. And then I stop for a couple of hours, take a break, and, you know, try and get my mind off it. And then come back for 2 more hours in the late afternoon, and then that's the end of the day, you know. And then I just, you know, vegetate, watch television or, you know, read or something, get to sleep early and start back in the next morning. And I can usually do that for 4 days in a row, maybe 5 days in a row, and then I have to stop, I get tired, so I take a day or two off, and then I come back and just repeat the process. And I'll do that for 2-3 weeks at a time, and then go back into the studio and continue with the making of the tracks. Maybe we bring a bass player in at that point and start to add it. There was always something to do on the tracks to make them better. And the better the tracks got, the more the song became apparent. That's what I found anyway. That when the tracks were really great, it was easier to write. Mm-hmm. And when there was something wrong with the tracks, well, then you were covering what was. You know, what was off in the tracks, you were covering it with words, and it really didn't work to cover anything.
Do you have a pet song from the album? I didn't mean that in any Beach Boy reference, but you know what I'm saying?
I don't think in Beach Boy context anyway.
That you can walk us through from conception to execution.
Well, I probably could do it on any one of them.
But which one?
Well, you take The Obvious Child. Okay. So that was the track that I cut down in Salvador Bahia in the square. In the spring of 1988. That was a real odd track because it changed not tempo, but it has a decrescendo in the right in the two-thirds point of the track, and then it goes into this strange little drum solo, and then it has that ending that's really, you know, really odd. And how was I going to approach that? I really didn't know, but there was something about it that reminded me of New Orleans. So my first attempt at making the track was to call up Alan Toussaint, who's a friend of mine and a musician I admire greatly, and to say, I have a track, and I'd like to see if I can put a New Orleans Professor Longhair style piano on it. So I came down to his studio, Sea Saint, and I sang him the melody that I had roughly. Didn't have any words, but roughly the melody. And the key, we knew the key because the drums always have a key. But anyway, that didn't really work. It wasn't Alan's playing that didn't work. That was brilliant. But there's something about the acoustic piano sitting into the 14 drums recorded outdoors. Didn't work. Then we tried Fats Domino's horn section. That didn't work. Then I said, I don't know, maybe I've written the wrong melody here. So I start to write another melody, which I made a note of in the studio. You know, like recorded it quickly on a Walkman and put it away. And I said, I don't know what to do. I don't know why this isn't working now, but let's move on to another song. You know, I'll come back to it. And so I proceeded to move on to like other tracks, and kept postponing going back to this track because it was a real tough problem to solve. Well, at one point I came back and I started to sing. We had a lot of fun, had a lot of money, you know. We had a little son, we thought we'd call him Sonny. And I liked that. I liked that joke. So I thought I'd keep that in there. But I didn't know where I was going with it. And I didn't know what to do with that little drum solo that comes towards the end of the track. And then I realized, oh, that drum solo would be great to have Sonny come back instead of being a minor character in the top of the song, where Sonny gets married and he moves away, Sonny has a baby and bills to pay, Sonny gets sunnier day by day by day, and then you think he's gone. So I said, oh, it would be good for Sonny to come back over in that section. Maybe I'll use that second melody I made up in Alan Toussaint's studio in that section and keep the first melody for the first section. So now the song started to take shape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At least I knew that there was going to be a character in the song called Sonny. I still couldn't find the instruments to play it, and because I really, like, I'm reluctant to try to play stuff on guitar myself, I postponed that move and tried it with a bunch of other musicians, and finally I said, I guess I'm going to have to play the guitar on this one. So I put down all the guitar parts, like four guitars, a 12-string and a high string and a 6-string and a synthesized guitar. And then I had a little change in melody, and I had the track required an edit. So we went in and we digitally edited the track. And then brought in Kim Wilson from the Fabulous Thunderbirds to play harmonica on it, as I began to know what the structure of the song was. Didn't have all the words, but I knew what the structure of the song was. And then I finally, you know, sort of broke the code, so to speak, in about April. And I wrote the song over like 3 or 4 days. But in fact, I've been thinking about the song since March of 88. But just, you tried this way and that way and nothing worked. And finally, when things began to work, then I began to be able to write the song. And that's, that's an extreme example since it took so long to figure it out. But trial and error is how this whole album worked. You try this instrument, it didn't work. Until finally you found the thing that fit into the track. And when it did, you just honed it just right so it sat there comfortably, and then you move to the next level and the next layer, and then try and fit the melody into that pocket and give yourself enough time to change that melody if it doesn't work. So it's a very tedious process, I guess, to the listener who's listening to this.
Well,
but to me, it's like, it's fascinating and keeps me off the streets.
That's what you do. That's your job. My job is to let the people hear the finished product. This is called Obvious Child from the new Paul Simon album, Rhythm of the Saints, at 92.3 K-Rock. This is Pete Fornital back with you on the Sunday show with my guest this morning, Paul Simon. Paul, I have always thought that the greatest compliment to any songwriter was when another artist covered his or her work. Do you agree with that? And if you do, what cover versions of your work have you been most complimented by?
I like, I think my favorite cover of all was the Aretha Franklin cover of Bridge Over Troubled Water. I thought she really did that song just right. And in a way that was, very different from the way that Artie did it, who I also thought did it just right. And two very different versions. A couple of years ago, the Bangles did a cover of A Hazy Shade of Winter. I thought that was a good record.
How'd you find out about it?
They sent me a copy.
And
it was a big hit anyway. I mean, you could hear it.
Sure.
They sent a copy to me.
But that's what I mean. Something from back then suddenly in a more current focus returns to delight you. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, they did a good job of that. Then there are some funny covers of my songs that I really enjoy a lot. Like there's a Frank Sinatra cover of Mrs. Robinson. It's just great where he says, so ring-a-ding-ding, Mrs. Robinson, Jilly loves you more than you will know. And I love that.
It would seem to me that you'd have to be complimented to have a Sinatra cover. A piece of your work. Is that the only one?
That he covered?
Yeah.
I think that's the only one that he covered. I mean, there's an Elvis Presley,
There's a Bob Dylan.
There's a Bob Dylan.
How did you...
There's a Paul McCartney cover.
I'm blanking on which one.
Richard Corey, Wings.
Oh.
On the Wings over America tour.
That's right.
Bob did the Boxer, I think.
Right, yeah.
You know, there's a very nice Emmylou Harris version of The Boxer, too.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
That I like. There are many more. There are a lot of covers. I've never heard a cover of any... I heard a bootleg cover of The Grateful Dead and Bob Dylan doing The Boy in the Bubble.
Whoa.
Maybe they did it at a show or something.
Uh-huh.
The stuff from Graceland, I just... that would be very hard to cover.
Sure. Sure it would.
It would be very hard to play those grooves. Well, I've heard a couple of bands play You Can Call Me Al and come pretty close.
In clubs?
Yeah, that's right.
Red Rubber Ball, now I don't even know if that qualifies as a cover, because it's not the traditional idea of a song that you had done that someone else does. But how did you let that one slip away? I don't know if I ever asked you that.
Well, see, I wrote that song when I was living in England, and I wrote it for money. Because I needed money. This was before Simon and Garfunkel, and I was just, needed rent money, so... I could get £100 advance if I wrote this song for a group called The Seekers. They were popular. They were an Australian group that was very popular in England at the time. And so I wrote it. I co-wrote it with one of The Seekers, which was a very, which is a way that assured me of having The Seekers record the song.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I could get an advance of £100, which was a pretty good amount of money in those days. And that was it. I never thought about it again. And they did sing it. And then there's The Circle covering The Seekers.
Wow.
And that became a big hit record. But, I think it's the only song that I ever wrote, like a commercial, pay me and I'll write a song. And, of course, I never would have anticipated that. It would be that big a hit. So it becomes a rock and roll trivia question. Who wrote Red Rubber Ball?
I should have known you bid me farewell. There's a lesson to be learned from this, and I learned it very well. Now I know you're not the only starfish in the sea. If I never hear your name again, it's all the same to me. And I think it's gonna be alright. Yeah, the worst is over now. The morning sun is shining like a red rubber ball. You never care for secrets I confide. For you I'm just an ornament, something for your pride. Always running, never caring, that's the life you live. Stolen minutes of your time were all you had to give. And I think it's gonna be alright. Yeah, the worst is over now. The morning sun is shining like a red rubber ball. The stories in the past with nothing to recall. I've got my life to live and I don't need you at all. The roller coaster ride we took is nearly at an end. I bought my ticket with my tears, that's all I'm gonna spend. And I think it's gonna be alright. Yeah, the worst is over now. The morning sun is shining like a red rubber ball. Oh, I think it's gonna be alright. Yeah, the worst is over now. The morning sun is shining like a red rubber ball.
At 92.3 K-Rock, that is The Circle from 1966 and Red Rubber Ball. I forget who wrote that one. It'll come to me. Pete Fornichal on the Sunday show. It is that time of year once again. Hungerthon 90 happens this year on the weekend of November 17th and 18th. Not that far off. And we need volunteers to take phone pledges those days. If you're interested in helping out, please call World Hunger Year Monday through Friday during normal business hours at 212-629-8850. That's 212-629-8850.
Still,
not that
hard. My stats are not going to qualify.
What I heard from you that night in your acceptance speech was, you know, real thoughtfulness, real affection, real humor.
We used to take the D train in from Queens, and we would go and audition for record companies.
E and the F.
The E and the F train. Well, you don't have to be so smug about it. Thanksgiving Day, 1957, we appeared on American Bandstand, and the kids actually did say, I like it a lot, you can dance to it, I give it a 95. The other act on the show that day was Jerry Lee Lewis. And he was better than us. Particular day. That was our only hit in the 50s. And then we had an argument, and we broke up, thereby setting a pattern that we were to reiterate in the years to come. How could I be happier than to be inducted into the Hall of Fame with my oldest pal, and we can join those other happy couples, Ike and Tina Turner, the Everly Brothers, Mick and Keith, Paul, and all of the other Beatles, and maybe they'll have a separate wing for all of us, you know. Probably be completed in time for the Eagles to be in. Thank you very much.
That's a nice honor, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It has all the people that you idolized as a kid in there, so it becomes an honor to join them. And of course, the thought that was in my head was like, when Artie and I were kids and pretending that we were disc jockeys and putting on rock and roll records and imitating rock and roll artists, you know, we never could have possibly imagined that we would be included in the same, you know, in the same group as Fats Domino and Chuck Berry and Sam Cooke and Elvis Presley and the Everly Brothers, particularly the Everly Brothers.
Speech had such funny moments in it. It reminded me of the days when you used to do monologues at the Forest Hills concerts, hysterical little funny story monologues. And then I've seen you in subsequent concerts where you don't do that at all. Just wondering about the role of humor in your work. And you even pointed to an example earlier on the new album of liking a joke about Sonny. Could you address that for a moment? Humor in songwriting.
Well, in songwriting. Well, I always put some jokes into my songs, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes people don't read them as jokes, and I think that's because. Most of the time, people think of me as very serious, so they're not expecting a joke to come. And also, there's something about my voice that doesn't tip off a joke. It still sounds serious. And I wish that, I mean, it's a quality that I wish I could have in my voice, a sense of irony or laughing at the same time as being serious, but I don't. So sometimes people miss the jokes, but a lot of times the jokes are, they're not that hard to get. I mean, a man walks down the street, he says, why am I soft in the middle now? Why am I soft in the middle? The rest of my life is so hard. It's just a joke.
What about the monologues that I referred to earlier?
I used to, when I was working in England as a solo, I used to talk a lot, and I would try and be funny. But I mean, the places that used to work would be these English folk clubs, which were really just a room above a pub. So maybe the audience would be in, you know, and the folk club would have a membership. They would come every certain day of the week, one day a week, and that would be what the folk club was. So you might be performing for 75 people or 100 people, and that's what the performance would be in a small room. Usually no microphone. You just stand there with a guitar and you sing. So that kind of intimate setting, it would seem natural to like have a conversation. And so humor was an important element in performing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came back from England with Simon and Garfunkel, I still had those, you know, I still had that rhythm going. So I used to do it in Simon and Garfunkel concerts. But as the audiences got bigger, you know, and as we started to play on arena-sized levels, it wasn't as easy to, you know, have that kind of conversational tone and intimate, humorous, you know, vibe going. So I stopped doing it and just sort of kept, just let the music flow. And so I never really picked up, you know, the skill. I mean, you have to keep developing the skill in order to be funny and let your brain go on for a while. There's something about standing in front of when you're standing in front of a band of great players, really you just can't wait to play. You know,
mm-hmm,
you just
sure.
want to hit the groove and go. That's my job up on the stage. I mean, besides the singing of the songs, is to lead the band through a set. So telling jokes is I leave it for Saturday Night Live performances.
Anybody who could stand up on national television in a turkey suit and sing Still Crazy after all these years has a great sense of humor. At 92.3 K-Rock, that's Paul Simon, and the title track from his album, Still Crazy, After All These Years. We'll wrap up our visit with Paul after these messages. This is Pete Fornital back with you on the Sunday show with my guest this morning, Paul Simon. Paul, two last things.
Mm-hmm.
As part of a benefit album, your duet with George Harrison on Homeward Bound has recently been released. I'm just wondering, did you authorize that? It's on the radio again. It's got a new life, however many years after it was originally done.
That was from a Saturday Night Live show in the 70s. And George called me, and his wife Olivia was putting together a project to help these Romanian children who are... There's a terrible AIDS epidemic in Romania because they had a lot of... They used transfusions with bad blood. So George called to ask if I had an extra song floating around that I could contribute, which I didn't. I was still working on this album. And he said, what about using, do you think Lorne Michaels would let us use one of the songs that we did together from Saturday Night Live, because we sang Homeward Bound and Here Comes the Sun.
Right.
So I said, I'm sure that Lorne will, you know, and that's how that came about.
There's a plaque at a train station in London, in England, I guess maybe a suburb, claiming...
It's in a town called Widnes, which is in the north. It's near Liverpool.
Okay.
Yeah, I've heard about the story. That's how I know.
You know what I'm referring to. Is it true?
There's a plaque that says that this is the railway station that I wrote Homeward Bound at. Well, it has an element of truth to it. It was up in that area, Widnes, Liverpool, Warrington, those are little towns near Liverpool. It was in that area on my first trip up there to sing in clubs that I wrote that song. I'm sitting in the railway station, got a ticket for my destination. On a tour of one night stands, my suitcase and guitar in hand. And every stop is neatly planned for a poet and a one man band. Homeward bound, I wish I was homeward bound. Every day is an endless stream of cigarettes and magazines. And each town looks the same to me, the movies and the factories. And every stranger's face I see reminds me that I long to be homeward bound. I wish I was homeward. Home, where my music's playing. Home, where my love lies waiting silently for me. Tonight I'll sing my songs again, and I'll play the game and pretend. But all my words come back to me in shades of mediocrity. Like emptiness in harmony, I need someone to come for me. Homebound, I wish I was homebound. Home, where my thoughts escaping. Home, where my music's playing. Home, where my love lies waiting silently for me. Silently for me.
You have been a famous person now for over 25 years. It's a part of your life, whether you want it to be or not. And I'm curious to know what you like about it and what you absolutely hate about it.
About fame.
Yeah.
Well, you know, a lot depends upon whether the fame is based on my music or whether it's based on being a celebrity. Whatever comes from my music is much more gratifying than just being someone who is famous for being, you know, famous. I saw you on television last night, or for whatever the reason may be. But in terms of fame, one of the things that I discovered that you can do with fame that's good is something like the Children's Health Project, where you can draw attention to a problem, you can raise money, you can have you can enlist other people's aid, you can go to Washington and go and meet senators and plead your case, and you can have some effect on the community that you live in a positive way. That's very gratifying, because most people, I think, would love to do that but feel that they can't. And I'm in a position to make that contribution just because I'm famous. So that's a very good thing about being famous. The lousy part of being famous is that the part of your life that everybody just naturally assumes is private is taken away from celebrities. And that's a really big penalty to pay. I mean, there's elements of your life that really should be your private life, The public's right to know, which all of this is based on. I can understand if that were being applied to a political figure, a president, where you say, I really want to know who this person is before I entrust trust them with you know, the responsibility to govern or something. But if you're talking about somebody who's famous in show business, then I don't see why anybody should have the right to know if your marriage doesn't work or whatever, if you had a fight or if you had a breakdown or anything that would be just really really private, where you'd think this is about my real life. No.
It is the work that matters. It is the work that will last beyond us all. The latest chapter in the work of Paul Simon is called The Rhythm of the Saints. We always tend to have these get-togethers around the time of your birthday, so I'll end this one with a happy birthday. Paul, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Pete. Good to see you.